Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Varma, today joined by Anlu Kiyada. Apologies if I sound a bit funny today. I'm a little bit under the weather, but nonetheless, we shall get into the news of today. First, we're going to be talking about the latest political developments when it comes to coalitions. We're also going to be talking about South Africa's ports, and we're going to talk a little bit about South Africa's chrome market. So the first thing is that the Patriotic Alliance has said that it is his part, it's the party's intention to withdraw from the government of national unity and, perhaps more impactfully, to withdraw from the ANC-run coalition government in Johannesburg. Talking to ENCA yesterday, Gayton Mackenzie, the leader of the Patriotic Alliance, said they are frustrated by ANC Mayor Dada Morero's failure to reinstate Kenny Kunene as Transport MMC. Kenny Kunene stepped down from the position of Transport MMC in the city of Johannesburg because there were allegations or there were questions about why he was hanging out with a guy who was being arrested for murder. The PA's probe into this cleared him of that, and so now the PA says that he needs to be reinstated. He's also the PA's candidate for mayor in Johannesburg. Gayton Mackenzie said, "We want to be treated with respect. We can't be treated like that by Dada Morero. He's got something against us, and we see how he treats the people of Westbury. He can't even give our people water. This is because some parts of Joburg, like Westbury and Coronationville, have had significant water outages recently." Mackenzie said, "So we are leaving immediately from the coalition and giving the intention to follow the process to withdraw from the GNU." The ANC responded by saying, "As the ANC, we know that we are in coalition with the Patriotic Alliance, and what we will not appreciate is the PA putting a gun to our heads. We will give the PA what is due to them in terms of our agreement. We believe the ultimatum is unnecessary. We should be able to go to the table and get an agreement. Kenny resigned as far as we are concerned. We have not received a formal communication from the PA that he's been reinstated. We only saw media articles. After he has been reinstated, we will be able to take it from there. And things will go back to normal, but this unnecessary pressure they are putting on us is unwarranted." So, Anlu, this is not great for the ANC coalition in Joburg, and that's because they, I think, without the Patriotic Alliance and without Action SA, who relatively recently pulled out of a supply and confidence agreement in the city, I don't know if they have the numbers anymore in the Joburg Council, especially also with some of the other smaller parties. Like Al Jamaha, sort of umming and ahhing and wondering whether they should still be in the coalition. So that's not a great place to be in. It looks like we might be headed for some more instability in Joburg. Of course, that would require a motion of no confidence to be supported, and then the election of a new mayor. Who knows who that could be? Because that would require an alternative coalition deal being put together. Which I'm not sure if that's going to happen either, because it's not like the DA and the PA have been getting on particularly well, or Action SA and the DA. So it looks mostly like the ANC might just lose its majority in the Joburg Council. But my other suspicion about this story is that I think that this is the PA looking for an exit. It wants to run as an opposition party, not as a party of governance in the next local government elections. Exiting the coalition now seems like a good opportunity to start running that just a year or so before the local government elections. What do you make of this story?
Yeah, I think you make a good point, Nick, and I get that same sense from the fact that they said, "Oh, it's because of this position, but at the same time, it's because they're not doing service delivery." So it almost feels to me like it's a Christmas tree, and they're just hanging all the ornaments on there, and looking for reasons to kind of leave the coalition agreement that they have at the moment. Whether they will perform better or worse in the next, well, in the local government elections that lies ahead, I'm not quite sure whether it will be better for them to do it, obviously when they're out of this coalition or not. Unfortunately, I don't know that. But the sense that I get here is that they kind of want a little bit, and they lost a little bit with this announcement that they made yesterday, in the sense that they, well, I think they won in where they said they kind of now look like the person actually holding the gun. And of course, now they look good because they've said, "We do this also because of poor service delivery." But then they also lost some because they've kind of reinforced this perspective that Gayton is the PA, which we know, but they've just doubled down on this. And whatever he says goes, which obviously comes with some uncertainty and volatility. And Gayton's line that they're not here for positions is hard to take seriously while he's fighting over a position. So, yeah, I understand, obviously, in a fragmented coalition, everyone trades post for support. But the endless bargaining that we've seen over the past year really keeps service delivery on hold. And residents essentially are just sitting around while politicians are counting their seats or their chairs. And what is becoming increasingly clear for me out of this, well, the entire situation in Johannesburg, is that coalition politics now really blur that line between local elections and provincial elections and national power, in the sense that a fight over municipal council really ripples through, and you also now see them putting in their notice for the GNU and wanting to looking for their out there as well. So we've said quite a few times before on the podcast, but again, South Africa is operating in a new political space, and we are just still trying to navigate and figure out how to deal with it. For the broader Johannesburg issue, though, which obviously is a massive issue, I think turning Johannesburg around is a brutal task, and it demands exceptional leadership and a very clear plan, and I don't think Dada Morero has shown either. The city's problems are very deep, and right now there's very little sign of actual strategy to fix them.
I think the problem for the PA is, while they, I'm sure, were finding benefits of being in the government in Joburg, that they are now, they don't want to basically be tied to what seems to be a sinking ship. The obviously we've talked on the show on Tuesday about how the DA winning Joburg in a sort of stable coalition seems quite difficult. But that doesn't mean that the ANC isn't going to take a hammering. And being tied to that government, I think, in Joburg is only going to hurt the PA, which is why they are skillfully making the decision to leap off the boat before it sinks into a waiting life raft.
Yeah. Which is probably the if I can just make a last comment, it's kind of funny because now the ANC almost took the wind out of their sails. Because they said, oh, no, it's fine. We're just going to, he just needs to do his whatever you call this. He just said he's as good as back. So I don't know. It's, yeah, very funny.
It's a statement letter. Yeah, no, it's been kind of funny watching the ANC on this one, because it's clear that they don't want to give that position to the PA. It's already being fought over by the EFF and the PA, I think, were both struggling for that position in the transport, and the ANC also wanted it too, and now they clearly don't want to give it to the PA, and so they're sort of coming up with all these procedural kind of reasons. Oh no, it's just because we weren't informed properly this time. Which I think is kind of rubbish, but anyway, interesting stuff to watch. I wonder if there will be another motion of no confidence. Maybe Dada Morero won't even make it to the local government elections, which is going to start the merry-go-round in Joburg all over again. Okay, let's move on to our next story. Two interesting parts to this story. So South Africa's ports have, for the past couple of years, been some of the worst performing in the world. Even countries that are much poorer and more dysfunctional than South Africa, like the Democratic Republic of Congo or Mozambique, have managed to have their ports actually score higher on the World Bank's Container Port Index for the past couple of years than many South African ports. In the one that was released this week for 2024, the port of Durban has ranked last out of 403 ports worldwide. Cape Town is at 400, which is just ahead of Pointe Noire in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Port Elizabeth Port is slightly better at 395 on the list. So really kind of shocking indictment. There's been some complaint from Transnet, who runs South Africa's ports. They are run, of course, by the national government, that the index only takes into account things like container turnaround time and not doesn't take into account all these other things like weather and supply chain disruptions and logistical problems. And it's like, well, you're in logistics. I don't think this is a very good defense of the situation. But anyway, interestingly, though, at the same time, the World Bank, in the sort of raw numbers, has said that the Port of Cape Town has actually seen the most improvement of any port in the world between 2023 and 2024. And they say that maybe this is signs that some of the government's efforts to begin reforming our port systems, to bring on board private sector players and to supply new equipment is actually bearing some fruit. According to the World Bank report, Cape Town has invested in new cranes and equipment, upgraded warehousing capacity, and introduced innovative measures such as a hydraulic shore tension units and a predictive wind model developed with the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research to mitigate weather-related disruptions. So, I don't know. Anlu, I am still a little bit skeptical because I think the problem here is that these deals to include the private sector, they've been kind of slow, and there's been a lot of pressure from business to get all this stuff done. But I think at the end of the day, government is not willing to let go of the sort of ability to micromanage these things and to, you know, include them in the patronage network, regardless of what agreements they sign. And the end result of that is going to be that, you know, we may see some improvements. We've already seen some improvements, but that it's, you know, until the problem is tackled more completely, we're not actually going to see major improvements in our ports.
Yeah, of course, the index still places at the bottom globally. And I think just what excites me about this is that we have a real life example of how things can improve. It's almost a kind of experiment to just show us, even if we just open up the space a little bit for competition and investment, results really do come in fast. You don't have to wait an entire generation for these things to start showing. So even in something as big and heavy and bureaucratic as a port is, so it really is exciting to just see that even just the little bit of improvement that we've had in terms of management and investment, it really does translate through. But I think it does certainly still point us in the direction of how long have we let our ports go? Like, how far have they deteriorated for us to, even if we improve, to still be placed globally at the bottom? And we've really just essentially let our ports down and let our logistics system drain itself. And this is all because South Africa can't really accept what is best practice and do that. I think we see that throughout the entire government. But yeah, for anyone wondering whether structural reform actually works, I think the port numbers are certainly proof. I think you don't need to wait too long to see the small effects and or the small changes that has big effect in this sense. We need to just give entrepreneurs the room to operate, and if we actually protect our property rights and get the state to not micromanage all these things, I'm sure that we'll see in the next couple of years, if that is the case, in the next couple of years, we'll certainly see much, much better numbers coming through.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Transnet has proven nationally that it's not good at running logistics, and that these functions should be handed more and more over to local entities, possibly the cities, possibly something else, to run these things as they wish. And I think that would be far more useful and have far more progress in some of the incremental reforms that have been implemented so far. But it's, you know, some positive movement here, but we are still in absolute terms just sort of, you know, or relatively speaking, just way behind the rest of the world.
I think which is
quite an indictment.
I think something that also stands out to me here is we have to keep in the back of our minds the role that political appetite for reform in this sense has. We've really seen a lot of pressure being put on government from the private sector and the public to actually open the market and open for investment. I mean, the risk is, of course, there that if the political appetite for these kind of reforms fade, that those gains could vanish. So this is not a sign for us to now back off and say, oh, but government is stepping in, or they are stepping aside. It really is time to just double down on those reforms that we have already seen and make sure that there is actual follow through on them.
All right, let's move on to our last story. And there has been a lot of discussion in the chrome industry about the problems of illegal mining and also South Africa's inability to smelt chrome. So, according to Glencore Alloys CEO Japie Fullard, more than 10% of all chrome ore being exported from South Africa is being mined illegally. This is accounting to about 7 billion rands lost in downstream value. And the chrome industry says that they believe the solution to this is to implement export controls that would more tightly control who is allowed to export some of these materials. Cabinet did agree to this last year, but apparently has not begun implementing this, despite agreeing to it, has not put any intention, has not put a notice in the Government Gazette yet to implement these new export controls. They hope that if the number of people who are able to sort of, if you need a specific license to sell chrome under the export control of the International Trade Administration Commission of South Africa, that this will prevent, may, or at least make it harder for illegal miners to sell their chrome and therefore hurt the market. At the same time, Fullard was complaining about the issues with smelting chrome in South Africa. Chrome has something, South Africa has something like 70% of the world's chrome ore supplies in the world. So the potential for us to be this absolute super producer is there. But because of rising electricity costs, logistical problems, electricity shortages, all that sort of stuff, for example, since 2005, South Africa's electricity tariffs have increased by 947%. It is no longer economical to smelt chrome in South Africa on a large scale, which means that we're having to sell a lot more of the raw ore to places like China, where they are smelting it there. And then it gets turned into to added to stainless steel and whatever the products it's being used in. So Andrew, there's sort of two things that come to mind here. One is that, you know, the problems of Eskom, it's not just about electricity supply, right? It's also about electricity cost. And I don't know if there is really that much of a solution to this that isn't a multi-decade project. You know, you can open up the market to more competition and things, but it takes such a long time to build capacity, you know, that, you know, I don't think we can solve the problem of electricity costs in the short term. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But my other thought on this one is, unfortunately, I think that something like export controls probably won't be that effective because, unfortunately, the state has too many corruption holes in it. If you, you know, you can create licenses and pass things, but at the end of the day, someone needs to actually sort of check in on that these things are being followed and that the stuff, all the paperwork is in order, and that those people are bribed. And, you know, if 7 billion rand is at stake in the illegal market here, it's very possible that, you know, those criminal syndicates that are doing this illegal mining are going to have the money to do that. So I wonder if the industry is going to be as satisfied, even if these things are passed. But anyway, your thoughts on all this?
So it's interesting. If you actually think of Zimbabwe, we have a quite a good case study there, where they, for a couple of times actually, it's not, but I recall in 2021 they implemented a ban on exports of raw chrome, to kind of focus on pushing local refining and local capacity to obviously then export more value-added products. And it's an old play, and it didn't bring new results. So export controls, definitely, it sounds like, oh, this is a wonderful action for us to take. Let's do this. But the economic record of it is really very mixed. In most cases, unless there's these controls are also then matched with enforcement and things like better border controls and policing of these illegal pits, if I can call it that, you simply push more of the trade into shadow channels, and then actually just invite more corruption in. But then, of course, there's this point that you make, which was also the case in Zimbabwe, where they just couldn't meet the electricity need and they had power shortages, which obviously then definitely did not help with local capacity and manufacturing and industrial base actually building up. So, yeah, the high electricity cost is definitely making local smelting essentially unprofitable. And it's putting these smelters, as you just read to us as well, who are supposed to be creating jobs, they just can't. And these jobs are now all at risk.
And it's...
So there is a very urgent need for us to lower the cost, actually reduce jaw. Sorry, you can go. There was a bit of a lag on my side.
Yeah, no worries. You know, the other thing that's kind of sort of crazy about this is that when you read any sort of ANC economic documents, or to be honest, even EFF or MK economic policy documents, they talk about local beneficiation of minerals as being like the thing that the whole economy should be based around. This is like all that government policy is supposed to achieve. We get all these great, you know, production plans and things that are supposed to say, you must... you know, have all the minerals manufactured or processed locally, because we don't want them being sold off just raw materials to foreigners who then are buying all of our cheap ore and then turning it into useful materials. And this will help reindustrialize South Africa. And that's kind of all the bravado. But, you know, as we're seeing, there are reasons why companies are not beneficiating materials here. You can't just sort of order it. You need to fix the problems, like
exactly
electricity, labor laws, planning, investment, all these things.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, definitely. And it's no, but it's almost this idea that they have that, oh, as long as we tell them, it will happen. And that's not how it works. You need to get out of the regulation angle of it and enter into a position of, okay, let's make sure that infrastructure is there. Let's make sure that the regulatory requirements are of such a nature that companies actually want to manufacture locally and want to develop these minerals, which we obviously have an abundance of, into things that we can then export for much higher value. And of course, then the value chain there is very clear, because it will also create jobs and it will also lead to economic growth. So again, I think, as with most of the stories on that we usually discuss here, we need to just streamline investment, make sure that new smelters and private energy projects can really enter into the market. And if we want a long-term, much more sustainable plan, we need to also get a situation where for our electricity crisis, which obviously feeds through here, producers need to be able to self-generate power, because that's, for the longer term, that's definitely the more sustainable solution. Export bans is not the sustainable solution.
Right. You know, I've read that the chrome smelters are some of the heaviest electricity draws of all the major sort of non-domestic or the non-sort of household costs of electricity. They use an absolutely enormous amount. I think, you know, another way to say this is just that if illegal mining is very easy and is undercutting legal mining, making legal mining easier would help to also reduce illegal mining, because it simply makes it more competitive. They wouldn't be able to beat legal mining's prices in the same way. And so you make legal mining easier and you increase enforcement both at the same time, and that will help to kind of bring illegal mining a little bit more under control. Anyway, that is all we're going to be talking about for today. We hope you found this show interesting. We will keep talking about South Africa's many issues and solutions for them moving forward. I hope you all have a wonderful day. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR, or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.